The doors popped a split second later, and there he was, voila, like a rabbit out of a hat. It was the new president, Jeremy Buckland, his famous face coming out of the car, dead center into the cross of the scope's reticle. The assassin held himself. He was in the midst of inhaling a breath, and he needed to wait for his exhale, for that still zone between the oxygen coming in and the carbon dioxide going out, where everything leveled so he could squeeze. He never got there. It just happened. Something happened. There was a bluish-gray blur in the scope, and the president was gone. What? He looked up over the rim of the scope. It was a helicopter. A helicopter had come from nowhere and was now level with his position. He hadn't heard it approach because of the headphones. The Bell 412 had police markings and was 20 feet out off the building's edge, pointed directly at him. There was a cop in it next to the pilot, pointing binoculars again, right at him through the hole in the blind. The cop was looking right into his face. The assassin stared in horror for a moment, then did the only remaining thing he could do. He shifted to his left and center-sighted the huge Barrett rifle onto the helicopter and squeezed the trigger. Chapter 7. It was one of those surreal moments when you say, "Wait, this is impossible, I'm dreaming." I just told the chopper pilot to head in closer on the east side of the MetLife building for a second look, when under the rim of the roof, I spotted something with the binoculars. It wasn't movement this time, but a box, a weird black box tucked in behind a bunch of wires and a satellite dish. The pilot moved a little more to the left, and through a slit in the box's front, I suddenly saw what was inside. It was a man behind a rifle. He was wearing earphones over a black balaclava ski mask and black coveralls, and he was lying prone beside an enormous black rifle. I had just enough time to drop my jaw when he swung the rifle right at us. "Sniper!" I yelled at the moment the muzzle flashed. A second later, the entire helicopter's glass canopy shattered, and cold air was rushing in my face, and we were spinning crazily. You could tell right away that there was something very wrong with the chopper. It felt incredibly top-heavy, hanging down and over to the right side as we wheeled and wobbled. An alarm was sounding in the console over the suddenly much louder whoops of the overhead rotor. All I could do was sit there in panic as, outside the shattered windshield, the sky and the buildings whipped past in a chaotic blur. I looked up and saw the hole in the cabin ceiling spilling oil. Then I turned to my left toward the pilot to see him fighting with the joystick. "My eyes! I have glass and blood in my eyes! I can't see!" he said, and then there was a horrendous metal groaning, and I rocked hard in my seat and blasted the side of my head against the cabin's bulkhead as we suddenly smashed into something and rolled over to the left. "What happened? What happened?" yelled Greg in my ear as a horrible metal snapping sound came. I learned later that it was the rotor and tail blades snapping off as they hit the concrete deck of the MetLife building's roof, where we'd just crash-landed. Somehow, I quickly unstrapped and got my door open and dropped over and out between the toppled helicopter's skids. Greg, the sniper, was right on my heels, and a moment later we pulled the bleeding pilot out and ran away from the still-whining, smoking chopper as fast as we could. Not yet truly believing we were still alive, we found a stairwell door and opened it and set the injured pilot on the landing as we watched the chopper spinning and smoking at the edge of the MetLife building's roof. I looked out at the incredible skyline of Manhattan behind it as I shook my head. If I hadn't already believed in miracles, I would have been converted right then and there. "There is no way in hell we should still be alive," Greg said. As we heard a click, it was a door opening in the stairwell one floor below us. Greg and I turned from the chopper and looked in over the stairwell's railing and saw the guy in the balaclava, the assassin, standing there one floor below us, staring up. Chapter 8. When I saw that the shooter had something down behind his leg, three things happened at the same time. I grabbed Greg by the back of his vest, I started to backpedal, and there was a shot. We tripped over the still-sitting pilot's legs and landed back out on the roof. I pulled myself up and drew my Glock. I was about to help Greg up when I saw the hole between his nose and cheek and the blood spray on the concrete beneath his head. He was dead. My heart jackhammering in my chest as I wondered what in the name of God Almighty was going to happen next. I pointed my Glock straight at the stairwell doorway. I walked around the pilot as he crawled back out onto the roof, and I quietly stepped back into the stairwell and took a deep breath and peeked back over the railing, Glock first. I let out a breath. No one, just a bare concrete floor. The shooter was gone. I listened. There was no sound of running farther down the concrete stairwell. The shooter must have entered the floor just beneath, I thought with a nod. I took out my phone with my free hand and thumbed return call.
Mike, what happened? Fabretti said.
Shooter in the MetLife building on the second to top floor, I said as I began to take the stairs down two at a time. He's 6 feet tall, black coveralls, wearing a ski mask. He's armed and highly dangerous. He just killed a cop. I repeat, just killed a cop. I'm on the roof coming down after him. Seal off the MetLife building lobby and send EMTs up to the roof for the pilot.
The pilot? What? Aren't you in a helicopter? Fabretti said. MetLife building!
I hollered and dropped the phone back into my jacket pocket as I pulled open the door at the bottom of the stairwell, carefully staying well to the left side of it. I waited and waited, then glanced in through the doorway behind my gun. Over the Glock's sights, I scanned a long, empty, fluorescent-lit industrial corridor with some unmarked doors on each side. Behind the doors on the right, there was the sound of machinery clacking and humming. There was a strong smell in the warm air. It smelled like a garage, like motor oil.
It's where the elevators are, I thought.
The motors for the massive building's elevators. I stood there staring down the bright, empty industrial hall as my heart continued doing road work in my chest. I thought about Greg, dead on the roof, and about the Dallas cop Oswald killed after shooting Kennedy. I was still thinking about all that, and just about to take my first step into the hall anyway, when a gun and arm appeared like a magic trick around the right corner of the corridor's far end. The gun started going off, and the concrete of the stairwell wall beside my head started exploding. There were three shots, then four, then five, and concrete grit dusting my face, and concrete dust stinging my eyes as I ducked and dropped back and kicked the door shut again. A small piece of cement must have cut my face because when I touched my cheek, I saw blood on my finger. I coughed and crawled back some more, as two more shots ripped jagged holes through the fire door.
Shots fired! I screamed into my phone. I'm up on the floor where the elevators are, second from the top. Get SWAT up here now!
Chapter 9. Mona Garcia, a 28-year-old recently naturalized immigrant from Belize, was in maintenance elevator number 2, and had just opened the door to the 33rd floor when she heard the overhead thump. She looked up as the ceiling hatch of the elevator car shrieked open. A man was standing there on top of the car, a man in black with a black ski mask and nice blue eyes. Those blue eyes were the last thing she ever saw as two federal high-shock hollow-point .45 caliber bullets entered the top of her forehead. The assassin dropped down into the car through the hatch and glanced into the hall behind his Springfield Range Officer M1911. Seeing that it was empty, he placed the RO down on the pebbled steel floor of the elevator and quickly unclipped the climbing harness from the ropes he had rigged in the elevator shaft 2 days before. The ropes were his emergency escape route, which he just used after slipping into the shaft through a gap beside the elevator machinery up on 49. He glanced at his watch. He had at most 3 minutes to get out of the building before it was completely sealed. He dragged the cleaning woman's body by the ankles out into the empty maintenance hall and stepped back into the elevator. Then he hit the button for the basement as he reached for the zipper of the coveralls.
"Help you, officer?" said a maintenance man, a skinny, pale, blonde young white guy, standing out in the hall with two other Spanish-speaking cleaning ladies as the elevator opened in the basement. He was gaping wide-eyed at the Springfield the assassin held openly by his leg.
"Listen up," the assassin said, with the cop command voice from beneath the brim of the NYPD ESU ball cap he was now wearing. It went with the rest of the convincing NYPD tactical uniform that he'd hidden beneath the coveralls. "We got shots fired up on the street. A cop just got shot, and the perp ran into one of the train tunnels. You got access to the Grand Central Terminal train tunnel from the basement here? I need to get to the tunnels."
Yeah, I think so," the kid said, blinking and nodding rapidly. "Through the boiler room, there's an old access door."
The assassin already knew that. It was how he had entered the building 2 days before. The young maintenance guy unclipped the radio at his belt.
"You want me to call the building manager?"
"No, no time. Show me now. There's no time to waste," the assassin said, grabbing the guy's elbow and urging him along.
Chapter 10. East 50th, next to the Waldorf Astoria, where the president was staying, was completely blocked off when I arrived there on foot with anti-terror FBI head honcho Paul Ehrenwein at around 5:30 that evening. It had begun to snow again a little, and through the swirling bits and gloom, I saw more cops per square inch in the street and on the sidewalk around the famous block-sized Art Deco hotel than on St. Patrick's Day. Unfortunately, a lot of news vans were parked 3 deep on Park Avenue as well, I noticed. We'd kept details to a minimum so far, but the helicopter crash and the shootings of Greg and the cleaning lady were already being broadcast fast and frantically out there in connection with the president's arrival. Paul and I had just come from working the 3 different crime scenes at the MetLife building, the sniper's nest, the crash scene on the roof where Greg had been shot, and the freight elevator where the shooter had killed the cleaning lady. We were still putting interviews and details together and combing for evidence, but the basic depressing bottom line so far was that we didn't know who the shooter was or, more important, where the hell he was. Paul had gotten a call from one of his bosses saying that we should head over to the Waldorf to give the head presidential protective agent a personal briefing, so we decided to walk the 5 Park Avenue blocks. You could actually see the silhouette of the crashed helicopter still on the roof from the street, I noticed when I looked up. Figuring out how they were going to get it down from there was thankfully someone else's job. After we credentialed our way past 2 checkpoints, we walked through the 50th Street entrance of the hotel's top-shelf premier section called the Towers of the Waldorf. Its lobby was amazing. An old New York gleaming, opulent jewel box of creamy marble and paneling and gilt moldings. I'd never been there before in my life, but I knew that, like the Empire State Building, the Waldorf had been built in the Art Deco skyscraper heyday of the early 30s. I thought that at any moment, Mr. Monopoly would come around the corner in his top hat and spats. Instead, Tom Kask, the Secret Service team head, arrived. He was a big guy, 6'5" maybe, well-dressed and lanky with slick silver hair and a cold, remote look on his face. If I had to judge a book by its cover, I'd say he looked like a big, dumb jock bully.
"So you're the cop who lost him?" Kask said, looking down at me as he arrived.
"No," Paul said calmly as he showed him some of the crime scene photos from his phone.
"He's the cop who found the guy with the Barrett 50 cal that you jackwads missed. Mike here is the guy who probably saved the president's life, and even your career, Tom, if you think about it."
There were a bunch of factors to explain why his guys hadn't seen the shooter, the incredible distance being the most glaring, but it didn't matter. They, the glorious Secret Service, had screwed up royally, and a lowly NYPD cop had done their job for them.
"Sorry, that came out wrong,"
the big bastard, Cask said, not looking very sorry at all. It's that kind of day, you know?
Yeah, you're right. It did come out wrong, Paul said, continuing to give him hell with his Southie Boston accent.
I was beginning to like Paul. He'd been totally hands-on in helping the PD and FBI response teams at the crime scenes. Not exactly a common occurrence for an FBI boss. Not bad for a Red Sox fan either, I thought.
Anyway, Tom, we're still smack dab in the middle of this, Paul said, putting his phone back into his pocket. Anything else?
Actually, yeah, Cask said. Follow me. He wants to see you. Well, him, actually.
Who, me? I said.
Who wants to see me?
The president.
Who else? Said Cask. Chapter 11. With that, Cask led me around a corner of the incredible lobby. We walked past two more Secret Service presidential detail agents and an impeccably dressed desk clerk into a waiting elevator. The doors closed and the button for 29 lit up by itself somehow, and we started to ascend. Cask ignored me and began checking his phone while I did my best not to gape at the impressive surroundings. I'd been in elevators for work before, just never a lacquered, bird's-eye, mahogany-paneled one that was inlaid with Art Deco sunburst and chevrons. The elevator doors opened onto a small, oriental-carpeted foyer where four tall, spit-shined Secret Service agents stood at attention. Between them was a set of bright white double doors with the words Waldorf Presidential Suite written in gold script. Before I could ask someone to pinch me, I watched as Cask opened the door without knocking, and I saw President Buckland for the first time. Beyond another small foyer, the president was sitting in a little living room on a love seat with his hands behind his head. His eyes were closed, and he was nodding as an aide read him something. Then he opened his eyes and saw me and stood up and smiled. "Thanks, Tom," the president said to Cask, who immediately left. "Detective Bennett, I believe I owe you a thank you," he said, offering his hand. I stood there for a second, staring at his hand, stunned by it all. "Yep," I got out as I finally shook his hand. "I mean, no, of course not. No, sir, are you kidding me? I'm just glad you're okay. I'm just glad to help."
"Ah, thank you so much, officer," the first lady said as she came out of another room. "The whole thing must have been terrifying."
She was snow-white, classically pretty, with her dark hair and pale skin. She had on a cream-colored pantsuit but was wearing slippers, I noticed, and I found myself amazed again that all this was actually happening, that I was standing in the Waldorf's presidential suite, enjoying a chat with the commander-in-chief and his wife.
"I'll never forget this," I thought. I couldn't wait to tell the kids and Mary Catherine.
"Officer? Alicia, really, it's Detective Michael Bennett," President Buckland said, rolling his eyes. "You think you'd remember the name of the man who just saved your beloved husband's bacon? I mean, did you even vote for me?"
"You'll never know, Jeremy, will you?" the First Lady said, winking at me before she headed back toward the other room. "Thanks again, Detective Bennett."
"So, Detective," said the President. "Please call me Mike, Mr. President, if you call me Jerry."
"Okay, Jerry," I said, finally at ease. I definitely like this President's style.
"So, Mike, I wanted to talk to you to get your first-hand opinion. I hear advisors say things that they themselves were told and on like a game of telephone, so I wanted to talk to you. You saw this guy, right? In your opinion, this guy was the real deal? He was going to kill me?" I nodded. "I was in the blind. Looked through the scope myself, sir. I mean, Jerry. It was dialed in right on you. He'd been there a couple of days, it seems. Not to mention the way he killed my partner. It was a hell of a pistol shot. My partner never had a chance. Then he got away with rappelling equipment in the elevator shaft. That's about as professional a killer as I've ever encountered."
"Mr. President," said his aide from across the room. "This just in off the AP wire."
The president turned. "The Russians have made it clear that they had nothing to do with any threat against the president.
They find the suggestion insulting, the bastards. The president's demeanor changed for a second. He looked down at the table we were standing beside. The emotion was there for a moment, raw, hurt, slightly afraid. When he looked back at me, it was gone, and he was smiling. "I'll let you go, Mike," the president said. "Miles to go and all that, but I'll never forget what you did for me and for your country." "Mr. President," I said. "What happened to Jerry?" he said as Cask appeared again. "Mr. President, I'm going to catch this guy," I said. Chapter 12. The assassin licked away the last of his chocolate crema and dropped the spoon and closed his eyes as he leaned back in the tufted banquette. The restaurant was called Elise. It was on a cobblestone street on the outskirts of the meatpacking district, and it served Michelin two-star French molecular deconstructive cuisine that was as absurdly good as it was expensive. The decor was seductively dark in the dining room and bar below, with dramatic lights thrown upward onto gorgeously textured high white limestone walls. With his back to the wall in the darkness, even a man like him could relax, the assassin thought, at least for a moment. He had just consumed a $400 nine-course chef's tasting menu that pulled out all the stops, a parade of caviar and white truffle risotto and fried sweetbread piccata and herb-roasted tenderloin of Wagyu, all of it arranged like museum-quality art and matched with preposterous precision with the best wines of Burgundy and the Rhone. He had gone hungry more than once as a young child, and since then, he had never failed to treat food with its proper reverence. To eat meant more than just filling his belly. It was a communion with something. Life, death, perhaps. He didn't know. He was no philosopher, but food was something just more. It was more than simply a combination of pleasant, sensual experiences. Ecstatically stuffed and drunk, he listened to the surrounding murmur of the expensive restaurant, the plate clacks and conversation and discreet laughter, the festive rattle of the bartender somewhere off to the left shaking ice cubes, music to his ears. "Can I get you anything?" his wife said. "A hot towel, perhaps? Maybe a pillow and a blanket?" "Absolutely nothing," the assassin said, opening his eyes with a smile. "That was expensive," his wife said with a frown. "Oh, yes, it was, and well worth it," he said, swirling his 21-year-old Elijah Craig single-barrel bourbon. He'd picked up an addiction to the American spirit 3 years ago on a job in Osaka, Japan, of all places. The Japanese were nuts, but he was all over their fetish for mastery. Maybe he'd been Japanese in a previous life. "I don't understand. The mission failed," she said. He looked at her. "Sweetheart, the helicopter landed on the roof. I mean, I'm one for planning for eventualities, but I didn't see that one coming. I come out and look up, and there's the cavalry. You know how close I came to getting pinched?" "All too well." "But I didn't," he said, winking as he sipped at the smooth fire of the bourbon. "If that's not something to celebrate, I don't know what is." "How about finishing the job, you know, getting paid? That helps with the way you blow it." "Darling, I had him," he said, kissing her hand. "His face was right there. We were in. He can be had. We'll get another chance, you'll see. In the meantime, I just got an offer I can't refuse. A quick little job here in town. You in?" She rolled her eyes playfully at him. "Ever the sweet talker, I see," she said, smiling. "Count me in, as usual." Chapter 13. Around midnight, I was doing what I always like to do after helicopter crashes and meeting U.S. presidents. I was kneeling on the floor of my apartment bathroom, pinning the family cat, Saki, to the tile floor. The Sockster had been sick the last couple of days, some upper respiratory thing,
and he wasn't eating or hardly even drinking, so Mary Catherine and I had to, per the vet's order, syringe feed him. Mary Catherine was on syringe duty while I wrapped him up tight in a bath towel. I was wearing kitchen gloves as I held him down to avoid getting clawed. With good reason, too, because Saki didn't seem to be enjoying his force-fed meal in the slightest. In fact, he sounded a lot like a Harley at full throttle as he squirmed. "So anyway," I said to Mary Catherine, over the ungodly howls as she slipped a paper towel bib over Saki's head, "I'm standing there and the door's open and there he is, Buckland sitting 5 feet away talking with one of his advisors." "No," she said, staring at me. "Yes," I said, nodding, still hopped up from the day's excitement. "If I wasn't currently using it for lion taming, I'd show you the hand that shook the hand that shakes the world." Mary Catherine smiled as she tried to squirt cat vitamin water between Saki's fangs.
"Ah, you're not so bad yourself, Detective Bennett. You saved his life, you did."
"Well, keep that to yourself, please. They're actually trying to keep that under wraps for now, a full media blackout, and it's working for once. Plus, I don't want the kids to know that I was in a helicopter crash. Not yet. They have enough to worry about."
"It's so hard to believe somebody would want to kill Buckland after his landslide election," Mary Catherine said, shaking her head. "How many states did he win? 44, 45?
46, I said. "Maybe that's just it. He said he was going to shake up the status quo, and he's got the mandate to do it. You have to think that there are a lot of folks with entrenched power at home and abroad who are feeling pretty rattled right now."
"Rattled enough to put a hit on a sitting U.S. president?" Mary Catherine said.
I looked at her. I didn't even want to mention the Russian tip from the FBI. That an attempt on Buckland's life might have actually come from the Russians, and that some new vicious revamping of the Cold War could right now be underway. It was too terrible to contemplate. I almost wished that I didn't know. Saki hissed, got a claw out, and raked my gloved wrist before I was able to subdue him with the towel. "I don't know, Mary Catherine," I said with a shrug. "Who knows today? Anything seems possible."
"Well, all that matters now is that you're home in one piece," she said, smiling.
"Couldn't agree more," I said. "Now let's just hope Saki here will let me stay that way." Chapter 14. Next day, around 4:30, I was uptown in Hamilton Heights, standing on the third floor fire escape of a building on West 141st Street between Broadway and Riverside Drive. Taking in the lay of the land, I decided that it had to be one of the most architecturally interesting crime-ridden neighborhoods I'd ever been to. There were stone row houses with Greek-columned entrances and apartment buildings with Juliet balconies. I noticed there was an equal number of Reno dumpsters and beat-up, tinted-windowed, cheap Nissans and Mazdas in the street in front of the buildings. Like every place else in the perpetually skyrocketing rent zone that is New York City, even the Heights seemed to be in the midst of gentrifying. Too bad I wasn't looking to flip an apartment, I thought. A shooting had occurred here the week before, when an entire 7-member drug crew running an ecstasy lab in the apartment behind me had been slaughtered. Such things happened from time to time in New York, of course, but the weird thing about it was how it had happened. Apparently, suppressors had been used. The power lines of the building had been cut. In some, it had the earmarks of a professional hit, just like the attempt on the president. We were still stone cold in the Leeds department on the MetLife building assassin's whereabouts, so we were looking at anything and everything that might be related.
"Don't jump, Mike, it's not that bad," Detective Jimmy Doyle said, as he and Detective Arturo Lopez came out of the drug apartment and stood beside me by the snow-top railing. My buddies and protégés from my special assignment in Harlem a while back were among the many 30th Precinct detectives who'd caught the 7-body case.
"Yeah, tell that to Chief Abretti," I said, flipping up the lapels of my overcoat as a cold wind sliced in off the Hudson to my left. "Now, one more time from the top.
Shots fired call comes in at 8:15.
Doyle said, mag-lighting the clipboard he was holding. Responding officers were here in five. Straight off the bat, they see the first body slumped in the exterior sidewalk stairwell down there on the left, then head into the lobby. The other four they spot just off the lobby at the foot of the east stairwell.
All dead. Not dying, dead? I said.
All seven well dead with one-shot kill headshots by... Doyle flipped through some pages until they got to a coroner's report. 45 caliber ACPs.
Whoa. And nothing was missing up here in the cookhouse? I said. How much did you find again?
900,000 in 10s and 20s. Twice that in product.
Just sitting there.
Doyle nodded. DEA had a theory about the crew, but not much else, said Arturo, as he made a snowball. They called them the no-name crew. By the setup here, the experts think they were easily one, if not the, biggest ecstasy suppliers in the city. Under the radar, the drug boss, Rafael Arruda, was a smart man.
That's Dr. Rafael Arruda to you, Mike, Arturo said as he chucked the snowball into the parking lot across 141st.
He was a Columbia University professor, after all.
Unbelievable, I said. What's the family dynamic again? Could it have been the wife?
No. The wife of the Ivy League's answer to Pablo Escobar checks out, Doyle said. She was his high school sweetheart, goes to church every morning. You should see his house. He lived up in Tony, Bronxville. His daughter was home visiting from Georgetown.
Canvas?
Arturo gestured out at the surrounding buildings with both hands as he nodded. We busted our ass, but nothing.
All the windows facing the front, right?
Yep. Every vantage on the front sidewalk where it went down. No surveillance cams pointing this way, unfortunately, and we only got a few people to open doors. They hadn't seen or heard a thing, which makes sense. It was the night of the big storm.
What time did you start the canvas?
Doyle looked at his notes again.
9:30, he said.
What time you got now?
4:30. Why?
Time to bust your ass again, I said. Call patrol and do the canvas all over again right now.
How's that? It's been a week, said Arturo.
That's why you need to do it again. It's been exactly 1 week since the crime. Someone who saw it could have left before you guys arrived on scene to question them, for whatever reason, work, a date. People are creatures of habit, right? 1 week later, they'll be home right now.
Hey, that's smart, said Doyle, looking at me. Have you done this detective thing before?
Chapter 15. The gallery was in West Chelsea on West 30th between 11th Avenue and the West Side Highway, directly across from the fenced-in Hudson Yards Penn Station Amtrak train yard. The opening night installation was called Solar System. 10 massive modern neo-expressionist canvases integrated with various materials. Burlap and stainless steel, flesh-colored porcelain and black rubber, brass and cardboard. The largest painting, titled Needing to Know No. 11, was embedded with a mosaic tile of cowhide and fractured plexiglass. It had taken the artist, Soyi, a 27-year-old Korean prodigy from Queens, 6 years to complete them. They were meticulous, yet somehow chaotically, primitively powerful, restrained, while being simultaneously, aggressively expressive. At least that's what all the critics who had come to Sponge the Vodka and Caviar were talking about. Matthew, the dealer and gallery owner staring out at the paintings, hoped they were expressing, "Hey, billionaire, I'm what you want on the wall of your new penthouse." Matthew turned as a pudgy blonde woman waved by the door after grabbing her coat. He smiled and winked and waved back at Hilda Breen, the critic from Art in America, who had called Soyi a definite new force in the art world. But would all the critical hype mean a sale, Matthew thought, sipping a vodka and tonic as he watched a pathetic and scarily dwindling number of people orbit the paintings. His client, Soyi, certainly needed a sale badly. Her unemployment was running out, and she was threatening to throw in the towel and go back to waitressing at her uncle's restaurant in Flushing.
Soyi had been so nervous about her show's opening night that she'd actually fainted about an hour before and had gone home with her mom, the poor thing. Matthew bit his lip as he thought about Soyi. Great reviews in the blogs and trade rags like Artform in October were definitely scintillating, but keeping a brilliant young artist from a mind-deadening day job would be even more brilliant, Matthew thought, with another swig of vodka. It was his downtown born-and-bred wife, Sophie, who had passed on the dealing bug. She'd gotten it from her father, a former artist who had owned a gallery in the famous 420 West Broadway in Soho in the 70s. He'd been friends with Warhol and had briefly represented works from Warhol's famous factory. He was actually now living in Palm Beach and mind-bogglingly rich from all the Warhols he'd been given. They were definitely not yet following in Daddy's footsteps in the big bucks department, unfortunately. The bills were piling up. Art was a big money business, but so were the New York City rents. They were a constant strain. Galleries searching for cheap areas that then increased in value, forcing the galleries to find somewhere else to gentrify. It was hard to figure where the next area would be, since even rents in Brooklyn were getting patently ridiculous. "Stop sulking," said his wife, suddenly linking arms with him. "Think positive now, Matthew. Smile, light this place up like Times Square. That's it. Turn on the charm. Sell, darling, sell." "Yes, dear," Matthew said through his wide grin. "Has our final chance left?" "Not yet. See? He's over by Crimson Falling." Their final chance was a tall, blonde, bearded German gentleman who favored vintage jeans and plaid work shirts, and who was known in the dealer world as the Berlin Lumberjack. Not much was known about him, except that he was a whale collector with edgy tastes and seemingly endlessly deep pockets. "He seems interested," Matthew said, still grinning to beat the band. "Not just interested, look at his eyes. He's mesmerized." "Mesmerized?" Sophie said. "He looks bored." "I've seen that look before. He's just straining to appear so, the crafty German. If he's bored, why is he standing there?" Retrieving his next vodka tonic 5 minutes later, Matthew was barely able to contain his surprise as he turned to see the Berlin lumberjack at his elbow. "Okay, fine. I need them," he said in a deep voice. "I'm sorry?" Matthew said, coughing kettle one. "No, you're not," he said, rolling his eyes. "I need them, all of them. How much?" Before Matthew could open his mouth, the man continued. "Now be careful, my friend. Don't be stupid. Do not gouge. There may be other people in the world intelligent enough to see the value of this work, but unfortunately for you, and fortunately for me, they are not in this gallery space here that is bleeding you $30,000 a month in rent. Choose wisely. Remember the goose with the golden eggs." Matthew did, but he knew he had them. He immediately came up with a ridiculous number and multiplied it by 3. Chapter 16. An hour later, they'd shoveled everyone out the door and called an ecstatic Soyi with the news. "We did it," Sophie said, kissing Matthew after they hung up. "We actually did it again, a 3-pointer at the buzzer. As usual, we dodged another, bullet?" "Never doubted it for a second, babe," Matthew lied. Finally, with a chance to sit down, they were opening a bottle of champagne in the office when Sophie's phone made a strange beep. "What is it, a text?" asked Matthew as he struggled with the foil atop the bottle of Cristal they had been saving for just this very occasion. "No, an email," Sophie said, looking. "News alert." Matthew nodded. He knew what news she was monitoring. The hit they'd done on Rafael Arruda up in Hamilton Heights the week before. "Well," he said with studied casualness. "It's nothing. A piece in New York Mag about the life and times of the dearly departed, brilliant drug trafficking professor. The cops are, as usual, clueless." "Have I told you that you were amazing that night?" Matthew said, leaning over and kissing her neck. "Maybe," Sophie said, smiling. "But tell me again anyway." Before he could say a word, Sophie's phone buzzed again. "Hold that thought," she said. "I'm getting a call. It's FaceTime. It's Victoria."
Matthew, drunk on vodka and victory, felt a skyrocket explode in his heart when he looked over his wife's shoulder and saw his daughter's baby bunny rabbit cute face suddenly appear on the screen. It was for her. All of it. She would have the best of everything, always. The best for the best. He knew that he and Sophie had in many ways failed. What kind of parents would do what they did? They'd participated in such utter darkness. But in his heart he knew that Victoria made it worth it. She was the sunlight that made it all worth it. Her angel's face burned away their sins with every smile.
"Mommy, Daddy, did you sell them? Did you sell Aunt Zoe's pretty pictures?"
"Yes, we did, Victoria, every one," Sophie said.
"Hooray," Victoria said. "So are we going to Grandpapa's? Will we swim, Mother, all of us? Will we swim in the ocean like last time with the glasses? Will we look for Nemo and Dory?"
"Soon, baby, soon," said Sophie.
"Can I have a pretty new swim snoot, please?"
"Of course," said Matthew, smiling at his daughter's face. "Heck, make it two."
"Hooray," said Victoria again.
Hooray indeed, thought Matthew, as he finally got the champagne foil off and popped the cork. Part 2. All in the Family. Chapter 17.
"Dad, don't do it. It's not worth it," Ricky said. "Please, Dad." "He's right, Dad. We need you," said Eddie, pretending to cry. "What will we do without you?" "If this is goodbye, Dad," said Trent, giving me a quick hug, "I just want you to know it's been nice knowing you." "Exactly. And make sure you have your insurance card in your wallet," said Jane.
"Ha ha, tee hee. Very funny, you Eisenheimers," I said as we all did a Bennett family fire drill around the van out in front of Holy Name School the next morning. All the younger kids were disembarking from the van for school, but Brian was switching to the driver's seat. His road test was coming up, so for practice, I've been letting him drive to his high school, Fordham Prep, in the Bronx. The other kids, of course, were really helping out as usual by sharing their confidence in his driving skills. "Don't listen to them, Brian," I said when we were finally alone in the van. "You can do this. Now check your mirrors, okay? Don't forget to look over your shoulder. Good. Nice and easy now, son." The van roared as Brian gunned it onto 96th Street. "Brian, no, that's too much," I screamed. There was a violent screech as he slammed on the brakes. A box truck's horn blew in my ear as it whipped around us close enough to almost shave off the side view mirror. More horns sounded over the pounding of my heart. Brian's face was as white as a sheet. Mine was too, as I swiped away the beads of sweat that were already gathering on my forehead. Driver's Ed New York City style was definitely not for the faint of heart. "Don't worry, happens to everyone. You can do this, son," I said. "Nice job, son. I knew you could do this," I said when we were safely stopped in Fordham Prep's parking lot 30 white-knuckling minutes later. "See you at dinner, kiddo."
Wait, Dad, actually, Coach Downey wanted to talk to you about something. He was going to send you an email."
Coach Keith Downey, Fordham Prep's athletic director, was also an old friend. I checked my phone and saw that he wanted to know if I could pop into his office one morning this week. "He mentioned what it was about?" I asked Brian. Brian shrugged as he shouldered his bag. No time like the present, I thought, getting out and following Brian into the school building. It sounded pretty suspicious. It turned out it was pretty suspicious. I found Coach Downey in the library making copies.
"Mike, hey, thanks for stopping by," the short and amazingly stocky Irish-American said, smiling widely.
Coach Downey and I had gone to St. Barnabas Grammar School in Woodlawn, where we grew up. He was a couple of years younger than I was, but I'd worked with his older brother bussing tables at Villaggio's, the only Italian restaurant in the predominantly Irish neighborhood. "Hey, Keith, what's up?" He put down the stack of papers in his big hands and looked me in the eye. "No bullshit, Mike. I got a favor to ask you. If you could do it, great. If you can't, that's fine, too. It's about Marvin Peters. You know how he carried the football team last year?" I nodded. "Talented kid.
three-letter athlete, Coach Downey continued. One of the best this school has ever seen. What you might not know is that he lives in a shit project in Morrisania. My job had made me familiar with that section of the Bronx for all the wrong reasons. It was a crime-ridden area dominated by drugs and prostitution. His Aunt Althea was keeping him on the straight and narrow, but as Brian probably told you, Marvin's aunt died 2 weeks ago, so another relative is scheduled to come up from the Carolinas to live with him, but it's going to take a couple of weeks. He's looking at foster care until then, unless we can get him set up somewhere. Let me guess, I said. You want to know if there's any room with the old detective who lives in a shoes place? Hey, sorry for asking, Mike. I know things are pretty tight at the Bennett Villa. I'm actually asking everybody I could think of. I don't want to let this kid fall through the cracks, you know? 2 weeks, I said as I took out my phone. 3 tops, Coach Downey said, putting his hands together in prayer. Hey, Mary Catherine, I said, and explained the situation to her. Thanks, I said a minute later, and hung up. Well, said Coach Downey, tell him to come home with Brian today. Hope this kid likes togetherness, not to mention leftovers. Turns out there's one last free bunk in the old shoe after all. Chapter 18. 2 hours later, I was at my morning's second academic meeting. Unfortunately, this one wasn't so benign. Are you sure you don't want to come back later, detective? An annoyed 30-something personal assistant asked me from the other side of the stately high-ceilinged wood-paneled office I was sitting in. I'm absolutely positive, I said, crossing my feet as I flipped through a Columbia University directory for the third time. It's okay, don't worry about me. I have all the time in the world. I was at Columbia trying to track down everything I could about the decedent, Professor Drug Dealer Rafael Arruda. I couldn't stop thinking about the professional way he had been hit, and that it might have something directly to do with the president's shooter on the MetLife building. But again, I must stress how highly irregular this is, the PA said. Vice President of Academic Affairs Hines doesn't handle things like this. You're in the wrong department. There was a lot of that going around, I thought. I'd just been to the chemistry department in Havemeyer Hall, across the quad, where I'd spoken to 2 other administrative people, dean this and department head that, about trying to find some information about Dr. Ecstasy, and they kept saying I had to speak to somebody else. My head was truly starting to spin from the academic bullshit runaround, so here I was, digging in my heels at one of the big kahuna's offices. Then again, maybe I'm in the right place, I replied with a shrug. Who's to say? Like I said before, Miss Short began. But then the door opened behind her, and a slim, attractive, middle-aged woman with wavy brown hair and a crisp camel hair coat walked in. Hi, Vice President, I'm Detective Bennett. Could I have a few words with you? I said, showing her my shield before the PA or anybody else could bullshit me some more. The Vice President surprised me with a wide, friendly smile. Of course, she said. Please call me Reba. Come in. I thought her inner office would be as stuffy with dark wood paneling and bookshelves as the outer one, but the decor and walls had a clean, modern, soothing California aesthetic. There was a cream-colored distressed desk against a denim-blue wall and a comfortable slip-covered couch. Light flooded in from an oversized window onto a miniature driftwood sailboat propped on a coffee table. On her desk was a photograph of a blonde girl of about 8. A glassy canopy of teal-blue water over her head as she surfed. Wow, great picture, Hawaii, I said as I sat down. The Maldives, actually, the surprisingly pleasant Reba Hines said, smiling at the photo. My daughter, Amelia, really loves the water. We joke that she has gills instead of lungs. She tilted her head as she leaned back in her chair, still smiling at me. She had sharp, intelligent gray-green eyes, I noticed. Detective, I normally don't do this, she said. But I take it you're here about Rafael, Dr. Arruda, right? Normally don't do what? I wondered, squinting. Cooperate with the police? Yes, I said. I'm trying to find out all I can about him.
What is your particular interest, if you don't mind my asking? Are you in the narcotics division? I believe we already spoke to some precinct detectives.
No, I'm in major case, currently working on a joint task force with the FBI, I said. We're investigating a national security matter that may tie in with the murder.
Reba Hines suddenly sat forward in the upright position with a semi-confused expression on her face.
Oh, that's getting a little ridiculous now, isn't it, Detective? First, Raphael is some sort of drug dealer, and now you think he was a spy or something?
I knew Raphael personally. He was one of the most popular professors on campus. Plus his narrative, his background, where he came from to achieve all that he's accomplished. She waved her hand dismissively at me. She folded her hands on her desk and looked me directly in the eye. Raphael was with some friends in the wrong place at the wrong time. It doesn't make any sense for him to have done the things he's accused of.
Well, we're very interested in finding out who killed him, I said. I'd like to speak to his students and colleagues. They might be the link to finding his murderer.
I'm terribly sorry, Detective Bennett, VP Hines said, frowning. We can't release any information about students. We take our students' privacy very seriously.
Not even to help solve the murder of one of your professors?
No, not without a subpoena. I'm sorry, the attractive academic said, giving me her pretty smile again. Now, if that will be all, Detective, I have a million meetings today.
Chapter 19. But it wasn't all. Not even close. Instead of hightailing it off campus, I grabbed a quick lunch at the nearest Columbia cafeteria. I was jazzed to see that it had a Starbucks counter, so I picked up a turkey wrap with my venti black. As I tucked in at a corner booth, I watched as my new buddy, President Buckland, appeared on the TV over the counter. On the news this morning, I'd seen that there had been a dust-up in Russia near the Ukrainian border. A school and hospital had been blown up, and Putin was claiming it was from a Ukrainian mortar attack and was rattling his saber. Putin was shameless in his desire to put the old USSR back together, with the Ukraine as his first target. His invasion strategy was straight out of Hitler's playbook. Claimed that because there were ethnic Russians in the Ukraine, Russia needed to support them by invading. Hitler had said the same thing about Czechoslovakia. And before he'd invaded, he, too, had staged false flag border attacks inside the German border, which was exactly what Putin's newest maneuver was looking like. But President Buckland was all over it, I saw. As I watched, he started a slideshow with satellite surveillance photos that showed Russian military trucks and soldiers coming in from the north to the supposedly Ukrainian-attacked hospital and school. Take that, Putin, I thought. Wow, that was a bold move. Buckland was calling out Putin's bullshit for all the world to see. Was that why that hitman had been there to shoot the president, I wondered? Putin knew he now had a formidable foe in our new president. Did he figure the best way to beat him was to clear the playing field? Doyle called me a minute later. Hey, Mike, major score last night on the re-canvas. A super up the block showed us a security cam we missed. I just emailed it to you. It captures what happened. It's incredible. Watch. I did. It was murky black and white. First, it showed three drug crew guys standing on the sidewalk. Then, a second later, they were flying like bowling pins as a motorcycle streaked into them. Two people leaped off the bike, already shooting. They were all in black, wearing helmets. One was smaller than the other, with wide hips. A woman? I watched as she put a bullet in one of the downed drug guy's temples, then casually walked toward the building's front entrance. Were we looking at a male-female hit team? That was a new one. And 2 on 7? That took some major guts, not to mention training. I watched the video again. The hit team was so smooth, so calm, just taking their time. These were no rival gangbangers. These people were military or ex-military major pros. I looked up again at the president on TV. 2 pros take down a drug crew a week before another pro tries to pull a Lee Harvey Oswald on Buckland. I ran through the video of the hit team again and again on my phone. I sipped my coffee as I stared at them.
I especially concentrated on the male. I tried to match him up with the brief glimpse of the shooter I'd gotten at the MetLife building. Both were about 6 feet with a slim build. But was it the same guy, I wondered? I just wasn't sure. Chapter 20. Lisa Hunter was a pretty, full-bodied, olive-skinned girl with shoulder-length raven dark hair and a lot of dark eye makeup. I met with the Columbia pre-med student at a little after 2 in the afternoon. Lisa was one of Rafael Arruda's chem students. After lunch, I'd gone over to the bursar's office, and after talking to a surprisingly unfussy cooperative clerk, I'd actually been able to track down a few names. One of the students I'd interviewed told me that Lisa was rumored to have been Rafael Arruda's lover. If that was true, my long-shot hope was that she might have some insight into why he'd been taken out by a team of professional assassins. I sat with Lisa on the edge of a sunny windowsill in the back of an empty Havemeyer Hall chemistry lab. Outside the window, across the quad, workers were brushing snow off the top of the massive dome of the campus's famous library. "Is it too warm?" I said, as I laboriously opened the big window beside us a crack. Lisa shrugged as she kept her eyes down on her brown leather boots. She took a Zippo lighter out of her laptop bag and started playing with it. She wore a gray hoodie that was too big for her, and I thought she seemed very depressed and vulnerable. Is that why the creep Arruda has seduced her? I wondered. Her vulnerability? Probably. I felt sorry for her. "So it's true about Rafael?" she said, her face going a little gray. "I mean Dr. Arruda."